I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. No big mistakes. That's the hope of each candidate going into tonight's third and final presidential debate. Polls are showing that President Bush lost ground to challenger John Kerry after the first two matches. So tonight, both candidates will try to appeal to the shrinking undecided vote. Kerry advisor Joe Lockhart says even though the debate is supposed to focus on domestic policy, he expects the war in Iraq will come up because he feels his candidate is stronger on jobs, health care, energy, and Social Security.
I would expect the president will, at every turn, try to turn this back, to turn it away from domestic economic issues, just because his record is so weak that he really has trouble articulating a defense for the last 4 years.
In a sign of strategy, the Bush campaign yesterday unleashed new ads attacking the Kerry health care plan to cover the catastrophic health costs of Americans. And Dr. and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist was dispatched to further the attack.
This big government health plan will raise taxes an average of $969 per year per family, regardless of how Senator Kerry says he might pay for it, it being a $1.25 to $1.5 trillion plan means that taxes are going to have to be increased dramatically on all American families.
Well, joining us on the line now from the campaign trail is Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, the Kerry campaign is probably right out of the gate going to have to respond to that charge. What will they say?
They'll say they're phony numbers or fuzzy math, as President Bush once described it. Senator Kerry has spent a lot of time coming up with a health plan that was specifically not about government control. And, you know, he's got pretty good ground to defend that. His challenge is to sort of distill what is a complex issue, a complex plan, into a sort of 90-second, 60-second soundbite for this debate. But that's always been his challenge.
Right. And tell us, how are each of the candidates in general expected to paint each other?
The Bush campaign is going to spend the rest of the campaign, not just this debate, but the rest of the campaign, tagging Senator Kerry with a liberal label. It's all going to be about him as a liberal senator and his record in the Senate. On the other side, you know, John Kerry's going to talk about wrong choices again. That's why you heard Joe Lockhart talk about Iraq. He's going to say a bad record on the economy and spending too much money on the wrong kinds of things, whether it's drug companies or the war in Iraq. So, you know, it's a sort of failed presidency picture.
Right. We're going to speak in a moment to a professor who says that both candidates aren't telling the truth on tax reform that's needed to spend down the deficit and to pay for things like health care. But do you think that tonight either candidate is going to say anything radically new about tax policy?
Absolutely not.
Right.
Not if they can help it. In fact, both of them talk in the same language about wanting to reform the tax code, to rewrite it, but actually doing it is notoriously difficult.
Yeah, I'm wondering, too, staying with domestic issues, Christopher Reeve, of course, passed away earlier this week. He was a proponent of embryonic stem cell research. John Kerry mentioned him in the last debate. How is that issue going to be handled tonight, do you think?
I'm sure we'll get a rerun of it. Christopher Reeve's passing away will certainly feed into things. You know, both sides claim they support stem cell research. John Kerry has a number of scientists who've backed him who say the Bush administration has taken a very restrictive position on this. So I imagine he will start referring to the scientists who've endorsed him.
John Edwards' comment will probably come up. He made a comment this week about stem cell research maybe one day helping people walk. He's taking a lot of heat for that.
Yeah, I can understand because the claims for what stem cell research can do are not supported, mostly because the research hasn't taken place.
Yeah, so that debate will probably happen at least a little bit tonight. I want to ask you something, Richard. We hear that President Bush is going to accuse Kerry again of being a tax and spend liberal. What kind of a fine line does he walk when, in fact, President Bush has increased the government and the deficit to the dismay even of conservative Republicans? I mean,
yeah. I expect John Kerry to come back right with that answer about the deficits, about uncontrolled spending. The problem about getting into a Senate record is that it also is pretty complex, and you end up sounding like you live inside the Beltway. One of the strengths for George Bush in 2000 was that he constantly said, I don't speak the language of Al Gore. I don't know what these people are talking about. I just want to go in and do a few simple things. Once he gets into the Senate record and starts talking about, you know, liberal ratings and votes on one or other bills, you know, he even talked about a supplemental in the first debate. That's the real danger, is stylistic more than anything else. But you're right. When it comes to spending, this administration has been pretty free and easy.
Yeah. One last question, Richard. I know you watched a little of a baseball game last night. What happens tonight, do you expect? I mean, the debates are up against the playoffs.
Yeah, well, for a start, I think you're going to see all of John Kerry's advisors have pleaded with him to make no references to the Red Sox, not just because of the result, but because nobody gets his jokes. So that's a big problem for him, and I don't know if he's got enough self-restraint to do that. But you're right. Everyone said this is a big sports week. Who's going to tune in? Well, you know, 40 million plus tuned in for the debates last week when there were competing things on TV. I think you're going to see a strong audience, not as much as the first one. That 60 million figure was huge. But I still think, you know, some people are going to see it, and a lot of people are going to see the news reports the next day.
Hey, that's what the remote is for. You switch back and forth.
Remotes, TiVo, the whole
right,
thing.
Right. Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, at least one economist says neither candidate will be honest with the American public tonight about the taxes necessary to address what he says is a looming $53 trillion deficit that will occur when boomers hit retirement. Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University says the economy needs a consumption tax, and many analysts believe President Bush is in fact considering a national tax on spending. A consumption tax has its critics, but Professor Kotlikoff says that with other adjustments, it could work. And he's here to tell us why. And what exactly is a consumption tax?
A tax on consumption, if it were properly applied, would be taxing every purchase that you make of any good or service. So if you're buying a hot dog, or if you're buying a new car, or if you're renting a home or buying a home, all the different forms of consumption would be subject to taxation. Now, the other way to tax is the income tax, which really taxes your labor income and also the income you earn on your assets, your capital income. So what's the real difference here? Well, we know that old people don't really work, so they don't pay any wage taxes, any taxes on their wages. So if you put on a consumption tax, when they went and bought things with their wealth, they would be subject to taxation. So shifting from an income tax to a consumption tax to a large extent shifts the tax burden from young people to older people, which frankly, I think is very useful in this setting because we have a situation where the burden on young and future generations is so high and already that getting the current elderly to help pay some more is very important.
Well, you know, Professor, people listening are saying this would be an incredible burden on the elderly, on the retired, and on the working poor. I read one statistic. Wealthy people spend about a third of their paycheck. Of course, it's a bigger paycheck. But poor people, even middle class, spend about 93% of theirs to buy things. Now, if those things are taxed, don't they pay proportionately more?
Let me respond to that. It's very important. I think that the sales tax has got a bad name, a bad rap. And I just want to be clear, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat.
You're a professor.
I'm a professor, and I'm not a politician. The consumption tax, the elderly who are poor, who are living just off of Social Security, would be insulated from that tax because their Social Security benefits would be adjusted. If the price level rose because of the tax, then their benefits would be increased. So the old poor people would be totally unaffected by a consumption tax. So we're just talking about the middle class and rich elderly. Now, it's true that some of these people won't spend all their wealth before they pass away. They may leave it to their kids, but when their kids get it and spend it, then the kids will get hit with the tax. So a consumption tax, to an economist, it's partly a tax on wealth. It's an indirect way of taxing wealth because when you have wealth, you spend wealth eventually, and then you pay the tax. So it's partly taxing wealth, and it's partly taxing wages. So now let's talk about younger people and middle-aged people who are working. Right now, they are paying high wage taxes through the income tax and also through the payroll tax. If you were to reduce either of those taxes and switch to a consumption tax, you'd in effect be taxing them at a lower level.
But what about the idea that the wealthy don't spend their money as much on things and therefore would be less taxed?
Well, I think that's actually not correct. There's not really any solid evidence that this wealth of high net worth people is not being spent. It is being spent on all kinds of things, you know, luxury cars, trips all over the place, airplanes. And even if they don't spend it themselves and leave it to their kids, which perhaps a Warren Buffett, who doesn't like to live high off the hog, will do, his kids, if they start spending it, they will pay the tax. So it's any way you cut it, wealth is ultimately going to be spent on goods and services and ultimately going to bear a tax. So consumption tax is actually a very progressive thing. If the Republicans were, if President Bush was coming out and officially advocating lowering taxes on wages and taxing wealth, everybody would think he's a socialist. His party members would disavow him. But that's actually what he's doing. To any economist who's worth his salt in public finance around the country, you call up any economist, they'll say this is what it is.
Well, you and many Republicans agree on imposing a new consumption tax, but they want to get rid of the income tax. You want to get rid of half of payroll taxes. That's the chunk of salary that goes to cover Social Security and Medicare. You have another plan for that. But it still sounds as if, in your plan, workers end up paying more taxes.
Actually, the burden on them would end up being lower because we'd be getting more tax revenue from rich older people from whom we're getting nothing right now. So you can see that since we're collecting the same total overall, we're actually going to be able to lower the burden on workers.
These people that we're speaking of that are going to provide this money, the rich older people, isn't their income from dividends and stocks and things like that?
Yeah, they have wealth, assets, financial assets, and they are receiving income on that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're spending both the principal and the income on consumption. Now, a lot of older people don't want to hear this, but they've been getting lots of transfers from younger people through Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and the younger generations can't afford it. We're getting to a point, given the aging of society, that we're bankrupting the country. So we need to get the rich and middle-class older people to help contribute to saving their kids and their grandchildren. That's the thing. We don't want our kids and their kids and their grandchildren to go belly up here because they're facing sky-high taxes in the future. And that's the situation. So President Bush, you know, he thinks that he cut taxes four times. What he actually did was raise taxes four times on the kids and the next generation because we're going to have to pay for all these deficits that he's mm-hmm. running up. We have to get people to understand that it's not me against everybody else. It's me against my kids. Mm-hmm. That's really what this is coming down to.
What are the chances of anything changing anytime soon? Not just because it's an election year,
yeah,
but just because nobody wants to do anything radical.
I think that, you know, I've looked at this problem for a long time now, and every administration I have the hope that they're going to actually act like adults, and they make the situation worse. That's true for the Clinton, in the last three or four administrations, it's the case. Just take the last 4 years. Medicare benefits per beneficiary grew seven times faster than the wages of the workers paying those benefits. So we are headed toward a fiscal crisis of very high dimensions here, and it's going to really hurt.
Larry Kotlikoff is a professor of economics at Boston University. If either of the candidates call you, will you tell us?
Absolutely. I think I'm the last person they'd call, unfortunately.
Yes, I somehow doubt you will hear from them. Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University. Well, coming up, swing voters. First, how do you change someone's mind? We'll have a psychologist's take. And then later, we're going to check in on two battleground states. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With President Bush and Senator John Kerry virtually tied in national polls, a small and shrinking percentage of undecided voters in key states could swing the election. Now, the question for the campaigns is how to get those voters to change or make up their minds so that they pull the lever for their candidate. Well, renowned expert in cognitive psychology, Dr. Howard Gardner, author of the book Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds, may have some thoughts. Dr. Gardner, welcome.
Good to be here, Robin.
Well, so to get the voter to pull their lever on election day, you've listed seven levers, as you call them, that have to be pulled in the voters' minds by the candidates. They conveniently all begin with an R.
R-E, in fact.
Yes. Can you tell us what they are?
That's a test of whether I can remember them. Actually, among people of an academic persuasion, the first two levers, reason and research, count a lot. But I don't think that's going to change any votes at this point.
Yes, we've heard most of their reasoning. But you have another R-E, real-world events. You say bring events such as 9/11 into your arguments. And then you have redescription. Now, I'm wondering, If, for instance, John Kerry's use in the debates of 90-90, that 90% of the casualties, 90% of the cost, was that a redescription of an old idea of his, which is that the U.S. is going it alone? Is that what you mean by redescription?
Sure. Redescription means make the same point, but make it in as many different ways as you can. Making a joke, using numbers, in fact, the repetition of numbers, as you just indicated. Probably the most powerful form of redescription is what I call embodiment. And that is, if the way you live and the way you act get your point across. I haven't watched the debates with the sound off, but people have done that at various times. And there's no question the gestures you use, the way you look at the audience was very, very important for the first debate. And those are all ways of conveying in a nonverbal way how willing you are to listen carefully and to respond empathically to a questioner and to listen sternly and to respond aggressively when you're attacked.
Okay, so we've heard reason, research, redescription, real-world events. What's left? Resonance, resources, rewards, and resistances.
I think the one I want to focus on is resonances, mm-hmm. because I believe that in the debates, the debate is really about resonance, which is how do you feel in your gut? How do you feel intuitively about the two candidates? And I break resonance down into two properties, likability and trustworthiness. Now, I thought before the debates that the likability was pretty fixed and that Bush was much more likable than Kerry to the average voter. But in the first debate, something odd happened. Bush acted very strange. He acted like an uncomfortable high school student. Now, I think he's recovered to some extent. Kerry, I think, also probably came off at least somewhat less wooden and somewhat more human, so his likability might have been propped up a bit. But ultimately, I think this election, like many others, comes down to the question of trust. Mm. I think that what's going to happen is some people, when they get into the voting booth, are going to forget all the arguments, and they're going to say in the end, to whom do I want to trust the country for the next 4 years?
Well, let's pick both of the major candidates, President Bush and John Kerry. And what could they say? I mean, again, using these levers, and we're concentrating on resonance, what would you have them say to change someone's mind?
I think that to change the mind of a Bush supporter, Kerry has to succeed in conveying Bush not as a resolute commander-in-chief, but as a reckless gambler. And he has to do it consistently. The problem is time is going quickly. And in Kerry's case in particular, he has too many plans and too many things he touches upon. Watching the debate as somebody sympathetic to Kerry, there were at least 100 times I said, stop your answer now. Don't add stuff. Stop at the good point. In the case of Bush, probably his best strategy is to be on the alert for everything that either Kerry himself or Kerry's supporters say, which support the notion that Kerry isn't being consistent. I think Bush has been pretty good at doing that, so I would probably feel that his strategy at present needs less to change minds than Kerry. I think Kerry really needs to pull an ace out of the hole, and tonight is probably the last night that he has to do it.
This is a science. You've studied this science. And a friend had given me an example. I'm not sure if I have it quite right, so you tell me. That if you cut in line at a printing machine, let's say you're in the office and you say, I need to get ahead of you without giving a reason. Well, you tell me, what's the science?
Great example, because it actually fits into the election. The truth is that when people hear a reason for someone getting in line, they were less likely to let them get in line when someone simply says, I have to get in line. Because if you say I have a reason, say, well, I got a better reason. I've been waiting longer than you. If you say I have to get in line, it conveys to you that there's some emergency. You project an emergency. I think that Kerry, being by all agreement a more cerebral person, probably thinks about reasons, but I just wish he would give fewer of them. And George Bush has really gotten this to a high art. He's learned that if you want to be effective in a debate, particularly against someone like Gore or Kerry, who is very loquacious, be simple, be straightforward, make your point, and sit down.
Right. You also say we tend to think that when we change our minds, that a light bulb goes off, that there's a big thunderbolt. But you say we may think that, but in fact, these levers are at work long before that, and there is no such thing.
Absolutely right. Well, it often feels, now I've got it. Now I've changed my mind. But then we go back and look over the history of it. We almost invariably find it's like a wave that's been picking up steam, and all of a sudden, so to speak, it erupts into consciousness. And so I would imagine there's some people who are going to get in that voting booth, and they're going to pull a physical lever in a different way than they had thought. But if you went back to the conversations that they had in the previous weeks, who they listened to, what they paid attention to, what positions they took in arguments, you would find that a good analyst could predict that they're likely to change your mind, while other people would be clearly not going to change their mind. I call fundamentalists people who've committed themselves not to change their mind about something. It's a waste of time to work with any kind of a fundamentalist in an election. You've got to say, who are the people who haven't made a commitment to change their mind on that topic, and then you really push there.
Yeah. I'm surprised to hear you say that, because I would think that you would say you can change anyone's mind, but you're saying you're using these levers, but you're saying you can't.
It's a question of resources. Life is short. Right. Resources are limited. And certainly if you're running an election and there's a few weeks left, Robin, you don't want to spend a lot of time on somebody who's committed himself to the opposite point of view. You want to figure out the people who are fluid, and probably the last person who talks to them, the last thing they read, the last commercial they see, maybe the thing that tips them.
Howard Gardner, he's professor of cognition and education at Harvard University and the author of many books, including his latest, Changing Minds, The Art and Science of Changing Our Own and Other People's Minds. And tomorrow on Here and Now, scoring the candidates in the truth department after tonight's debate. Who stretched the truth at times? Who out and out, well, we won't say, lied? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. They're back behind the podiums tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. George Bush and John Kerry debate for the third and final time at Arizona State University in Tempe. And with the candidates focusing their attention on the battleground states, Here Now's Bob Oakes spoke to Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire, and Jeff Stein, political analyst and assistant professor of electronic media at Wartburg College in Iowa.
Jeff, let's start with you. What do the recent poll numbers look like in Iowa?
An absolute dead heat. One television station's poll has Bush ahead by a point. The other has Kerry ahead by a point. And the last poll that was done by Gallup had the president up by 6 points. But keep in mind, that was before any of the debates. What we're really seeing consistently is a few points one way or the other. And the current polls are just showing that it's all within the margin of error, too close to call.
And what about New Hampshire, Guy McMillan?
Well, I hate to be boring, but it's the same situation here. I ought to start by saying that the polls in New Hampshire have been notoriously inaccurate over the years. I don't know whether the voters here are particularly mercurial or whether the pollsters aren't very good, but right now they are showing a dead heat. Two polls have Kerry up by 6 and 7 points, respectively. One poll has Bush up by 5 points, and the other shows a dead tie at 47-47.
Guy, tell me about the debate tonight. Do you think it'll be pivotal?
I think the debates, all three of them, have been very important, but my point here is that there's another 2 weeks after the debates are all over, and whatever impression they have made, and I think they've been good for Kerry, there's still a couple of weeks for Kerry to be painted as, you know, the liberal flip-flopper, and so I'm not sure in the end that they will be pivotal.
Jeff Stein, what about you? Are Iowans paying attention to the debate, and how important is the debate tonight?
We're not used to being a, quote, battleground state, and so folks are paying a lot of attention, and the candidates are paying a lot of money. $1.6 million was spent on TV ads in Iowa last week alone, and Kerry is outspending Bush almost 2-1, if you include the Democratic National Committee money, and so they're really trying to throw a lot of money here. The Democrats won in Iowa in 2000, but it's up for grabs now, and they don't want to lose the 7 electoral votes that they had 4 years ago.
Let me ask a couple of questions about a couple of issues. 15 Iowans have died in the war in Iraq. Jeff, is the war the main issue that will influence voters there?
It absolutely is. Our unemployment rate in the state is below the national average. The economy is doing fairly well. And even though we've had so many people die who came from Iowa, I still think the issue may favor the president, depending on last-minute issues in Iraq, because folks here, I think, don't necessarily want to change commanders-in-chief in midstream.
Since both President Bush and John Kerry are trying to make this race about the other guy, is Kerry in New Hampshire succeeding at all in painting the effort to win the peace in Iraq as a misguided and underestimated affair?
I think he is, but I think he's succeeded with people that already believe that, and they buy that argument. I'm not sure that Kerry has broken into, say, the hardcore Republican ranks and convinced many Republicans that the war in Iraq is a mistake.
And Jeff Stein, what about that effort in Iowa?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to remember when you're looking at John Kerry in Iowa is the fact that even though he won the caucuses here and it really gave him that boost before New Hampshire, more than two-thirds of our electorate didn't participate then. We have more registered independents than either registered Democrats or registered Republicans. And so it's really hard to determine how some of these traditional methods of getting through to people are going to work.
On the subject of the word liberal, on the other side, how about President Bush's liberal use of the word liberal? Is Mr. Bush succeeding in painting Mr. Kerry as a Massachusetts liberal? And does that have any anti-Kerry currency in your state, Jeff?
It really doesn't have any anti-Kerry currency because we have two U.S. senators. One is one of the more conservative ones in the country in Charles Grassley, and one is one of the more liberal ones in Tom Harkin. For some reason, Iowans continually vote in an inconsistent way with regard to our U.S. senators. And so when you hear George Bush call John Kerry a liberal, yes, that does speak to the core, but that labeling alone doesn't turn people off in this state.
And how about in New Hampshire, Guy McMillan, which, of course, neighbors liberal Massachusetts?
Well, yeah, Massachusetts is sort of like New Hampshire's France. You know, we like to visit it and everything. But around politicians, the word is semi-salacious, and they call it Taxachusetts. And so coming from Massachusetts is not in and of itself an advantage here in New Hampshire. That having been said, I don't think John Kerry is going to be perceived as some sort of radical crazy person by the people of New Hampshire because, after all, we have watched him over the last 20 years on television as he's been in the U.S. Senate from a neighbor state.
And finally, given that the polls show the race very close in both states, do you expect it to stay close right up to Election Day, November 2nd?
I absolutely do. This election in Iowa was decided 4 years ago by less than 1% of all the votes cast. That was something like 4,000 votes statewide. And I definitely feel we've got the president coming to a large city again this week for the second time in 2 weeks. Senator Kerry is coming again this week. It's going to be close right up to the last minute with a huge infusion of new voters, and that could change everything.
And, Jeff, as I asked Guy this question earlier, what's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that Bush has the advantage because when push comes to shove, folks are not going to want to change leaders during the middle of a war. But it's going to be absolutely razor thin if he's going to win this time.
And Guy McMillan, razor thin to Election Day in New Hampshire?
Oh, I think so, yes. The president's been here several times. The senator has been here at least once and probably will be back. I think it's going to be very close right down to the wire. It was in 2000. In fact, were it not for Ralph Nader, it's thought that Al Gore would have won this state in 2000. So this is very much a state in play.
Guy McMillan, editorial page editor with the newspaper The Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Stein, political analyst and assistant professor of electronic media at Wartburg College in Iowa. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Well, in addition to deciding who to vote for, Americans have to decide what to watch, debate or baseball playoffs, paper, plastic. Here are some thoughts from Red Sox Nation.
Definitely going to watch the game. I've already seen two debates. It's been about equal on both of them, so why Imagine the third will be the same.
Well, I'm really torn, so I was hoping I could switch back and forth between the two.
Probably the game. Like, I'm probably going to be voting for Kerry, so I've already made up my mind. I'm not too.
I'm going to probably flip between both. I'm very interested in both of them, and it becomes a hard decision, but I figured I'd watch them both and try and go back and forth as much as possible. Usually the innings are long and boring, so I can get in between them.
I'm going to watch the debate tonight. Well, I'm not going to watch anything tonight, but when it comes on demand, I'm going to watch it.
In terms of my plans tonight, I'm watching the game. I'm not watching the debate. I already know who I'm voting for. I'm getting Bush out. So, go Sox!
What to watch, what to watch. The thoughts of some Bostonians. Still to come, composer Osvaldo Golahov. You're listening to Here and Now. Saudi Arabia has announced that women will not be allowed to vote or run for office in the country's first nationwide elections. This news has dashed the hopes of many women in the country who thought the municipal elections in February would give them a more visible role in Saudi society. Well, we spoke to Nadia Bakirji last month. She was the first woman to announce her candidacy for office, and she joins us again today from her home in the Saudi Arabian city of Riyadh, the capital. Nadia, what is your reaction to the government's decision?
Well, I'm slightly surprised because I was quite optimistic. I was hoping that they would find the mechanisms to include us this time around, because a lot of initiatives have been put forward to the election committee regarding ways of solving the certain logistical problems. So, you know, the news does come as a bit of a disappointment.
Well, do you agree with their assessment that there just isn't enough time to hire and train the women that have to support the elections, because women would have to vote separately?
Well, obviously, the whole election process is very new to Saudi Arabia, so a great deal of educating the public has to be done in the meantime anyway. Regarding training women in time, obviously, this would be quite a task that would have to be organized quickly. I do respect the government's time frame in that sense. But there are other ways of including the women on the municipality council. For example, they can include us through a quota, because 50% of the seats are actually allocated and 50% are elected. So if they give us a percentage of the allocated seats, then at least that's a way of introducing women's representation without putting them through the electoral process, which obviously they feel they won't be ready in time for anyway.
What about, though, the thinking that still seems to exist that if not on a religious basis, there's another basis that women shouldn't be involved? In an Associated Press article here in the States, a female 19-year-old university student is quoted as saying, "Women don't know how to vote with their minds like men. They vote with their emotions."
Well, I don't know who this 19-year-old girl is, but I don't think she's experienced enough to be able to come up with an assumption like that.
But Nadia, that statement, a statement like that, adds to the perception in other parts of the world that this statement from the Saudi government is just a smokescreen. You know, that they just threw out logistics, but really, there are people who don't want women to vote.
Well, Prince Mansour bin Mutaib did actually say that he promised to look into the initiatives on how to include women in the process. I don't know whether he meant for this time round or next time round. Obviously, there are certain delicate sensitivities that they have to be careful about, but we were hoping that this was a really good opportunity for Saudi Arabia to, you know, create that positive image for our society in our country.
Last time we spoke, we had an analyst on from the States who said he was actually cautioning the Saudi Arabia not to include women because he was afraid it would lead to too much violence from the fundamentalists in the country.
That threw me a lot, actually. I think that was an exaggeration. Frankly, ever since I announced my candidacy some time back, I haven't received any negative response from any side. And in fact, even in the media, it's been really quiet. There's been no response from any clerics or any fundamentalists.
Well, you've said you'd like the government to appoint women to seats in the municipalities. What else would you like to see now?
We would hope that there'd be some transparency regarding a time frame of when they will include women in the election process. I think what they could benefit from is creating committees of women who are representing the females in Saudi society and bringing the woman's voice to the municipality council. They don't have to be candidates. They can be these can be committees. They could be think tanks.
Well, Nadi, one last question. Just this past weekend, there were elections in Afghanistan, also a Muslim country with very traditional beliefs. Many women went to the polls. In some villages, they didn't, but many did. What was it like for you to witness that or to watch it from afar?
Well, it was very interesting, and I'm very proud of my Afghan sisters. What can I say? My hat off to them that they've managed to turn things around 180 degrees in their country. Maybe we do have more hurdles at the moment that need to be overcome.
Nadia Bakirji, she spoke to us from her home in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, having found out she cannot run for office. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Composer Osvaldo Golahov, whose St. Mark Passion electrified the classical world 4 years ago, has completed his first composition for solo piano. It's called Levante, Fantasy on a Chorus from the St. Mark Passion. And this week, Golahov rehearsed the piece at the Cambridge, Massachusetts home of pianist Veronica Yoakum.
I thought that A was even too loud, so I stopped.
Yeah, but there should be like a longer question. Once you did it twice, this then you gain four.
So we should again do that. Sorry.
The piano piece is adapted from Golahov's St. Mark Passion, which is an eclectic blend of Latin American folk and dance music, Middle Eastern motifs, with lyrics from the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. Well, Golahov's piano adaptation will debut this weekend at Boston's New England Conservatory, played by Veronica Yoakum, daughter of famed conductor Eugen Yoakum. How does a composer hand off a new piece? We eavesdrop to find out.
Yeah, then that crescendo or that forte again?
That was excellent, yeah.
Uh-huh. May I interrupt for just a moment to ask you about your work in progress here? How did this come about?
Started in 2002 when Europe was celebrating my father Eugen Jochum's 100th birthday. I mean, what would have been his 100th birthday. And I wanted to honor my father with having Osvaldo write a piece. And somehow I had heard the Passion. I wasn't here when it was first performed, but I heard it on the radio. And I have lived in Latin America. And the big discovery for me was the discovery of the Latin American music.
And so Osvaldo enters the picture. I'm not going to ask you if it was intimidating to write a piece for someone, because you don't seem intimidated by much, but what was your reaction?
I was intimidated, of course I was. And then because of that intimidation, I took so long that the anniversary passed. And I said, I'm never going to do this. And then Veronica said, no, keep trying. And finally I did something.
Then he told me at one point, the piece is coming. That was this year already.
Yeah.
And he said it's going to be based on the number 11 from the Passion. So I listened to that, and I listened to that, and I listened to it over and over again. And it's a story of Judas betraying Christ, selling Christ. And I said, wow, that's really something. So, and then the piece came. But now you have to tell the other story.
Yeah, well, even if I play the piano, I'm really bad at the piano. And I have my bad memories about my piano teacher trying to throw me out of her class every week and so forth. So that's why it took me so long to finally write for the piano. So when I said I'm thinking of giving up, Veronica said, no, why don't you just take something from...
There's no reason why his music shouldn't be wonderful on the piano, even if... He said he's intimidated.
Yeah. So how do you adapt a huge choral piece? Explain to people. In fact, we should probably listen to a little bit of the original piece and remind people of what this sounded like in its fullness. Let's do that. Now, how do you get, Oswaldo, all of that energy and excitement out of a piano key?
Yeah, well, that's the whole challenge, right? So, well, I mean, for instance, you saw that there is like a big percussion component in that, in the original. And you have this wonderful rhythm machine that goes on and goes on. And with the piano, you only have two hands. So that percussion that makes people dance, you have to insinuate that, to only take what are the really spicy beats out of all those percussionists are playing.
Can you show me some of that, Veronica, with your left hand, some of the percussive?
Yeah. Is that pianists, of course, don't always want to play so rough, so you sometimes want to play nicely, okay? And he wants a left hand. Much more. So I start. Oswaldo kept saying more left hand. I said, and he said, no, even more staccato. Is that better?
Yeah, that's great. So then you see, I mean, if it was just the bass player of the orchestra and the percussion, you have basically every beat. In the piano you have, you know, so between the interaction between the rests, the small rests and the notes, make give the spice, the flavor that was in the original.
How do you talk to each other? What's some of the language that you use, Veronica?
Music. And I mean just playing. And then he says, oh, that could be more spicy. Make a crescendo to the end, to the last note. You know what he's doing. And when we first did that, he was dancing. It was just fantastic.
And for this particular pianist, anything that you needed special to convey something to her?
I think Veronica is very subtle, very, you know, I know that if I ask her for something, she says, well, do you mean vulgar? So I realize that she's not in agreement with what I asked. So I said, no.
You once said vulgar.
Oh, did I?
You said, yes, absolutely vulgar.
No, it's good.
Said, well, but he said, a Cuban meal and a drunken priest is telling the story of the Bible. And I mean, that is this kind of what I cannot do on the piano. Just, you know, it's kind of really...
Of getting a little bit drunk.
Veronica Yoakum, do you think that your father... I mean, I imagine you do think your father's been honored with
this. Oh, he would have loved it. Yeah. My father would have been stunned and would have loved it, I'm sure.
And Oswaldo, we see you adapting a portion of the Passion. The pressure on you post-Passion, I imagine, has been extraordinary. You're raising eyebrows.
Yeah, but it's luckily it's over. So, I mean, or at least I think I was able to go on with my life and do other things. You know, it was a little overwhelming at the beginning, but now I think I'm on a groove again.
You've had some beautiful pieces since, obviously, but do you have another huge piece like that, or does that take...
Yeah, I have. I'm working on a big symphony that will be the basis of a soundtrack for an epic movie by Francis Ford Coppola. I think that's pushing me to stretch myself, and I'm very excited. I think it's going to be pretty big.
With the energy of the two of you in this room, it's like the room could explode. So we'll let you get back to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Robin.
Composer Oswaldo Golahov and pianist Veronica Yoakum. Oswaldo's new composition, Levante, Fantasy on a Chorus from the St. Mark Passion, will have its world premiere this Sunday at Veronica Yoakum's recital. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
What will start that recital will be a Bach choral prelude in my own transcription, and again, it figures big in the St. Matthew Passion.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. Thank you.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.